Welcome to The Good Stuff with Sonoma County Wine Growers. I'm Virginie Boone, alongside CEO of The Wine Growers, Carissa Cruz, here to talk about what makes Sonoma County such a special place to grow, make, and enjoy wine.
And I'm jamming.
And are we enjoying, where are we now?
We are enjoying wine because we are pre-recording this show. And right now, on Saturday afternoon, May 16th, I'm zipping around the grand tasting at the Healdsburg Wine and Food Experience.
Is that what you'll be doing at this exact moment when this starts airing?
It will be.
Do you know where exactly where you're
going to
be?
I will be. Okay. Yeah.
I cannot commit to that.
How about yourself?
I'm not committing to where I will be at that time.
Oh, okay.
Well.
But I might be zipping.
Well, you will have spent last evening with me.
Right. So, yeah. So, exactly why I can't commit
I know,
to what so. Where I will be Saturday.
No. So, it's been obviously this week is always an exciting week. It's our fifth annual Healdsburg Wine and Food Experience. Today, Saturday, the 16th, is the grand tasting. Lots of stuff going on, but this week leading up, which you've helped us with, which you will be helping us with.
Yes, I will.
In retrospect, have helped us with.
It's already happened.
It's very confusing. we have 10 Psalm sommeliers in town from around the country. We have 10 Psalms in town from Canada and Mexico joining us in partnership with the Wine Institute. They brought in our international Psalms, and we have been doing multiple days of kind of immersion in Sonoma County, wine education, truck talks with our growers, an opening dinner at Copan.
Mm-hmm. And nice.
Yeah, so that'll be great. Thank you to them, that winery, for hosting us. And then what will be happening Friday night, which is now last night, which should be really fun. I know. We got to keep up
my
with all this
gonna
stuff.
Explode.
I know. Yeah. We are doing a Psalm Showdown dinner at Dry Creek Kitchen. So we have...
Tell me more.
So consumers, and you're judging, so you should know all the details. but we have teams of Psalms kind of doing a competition of recommending what they think will be the best wine to go with Chef Charlie Palmer and other, the chef of Dry Creek, and their different courses. And then there's kind of a People's Choice Award. And then, Virginie, you will be judging with Evan Goldstein and Ray Isle for the Expert Award.
I want to be with the people.
You want to be with the people.
I want to be with the people.
We can move you into the people.
Yeah. I love it when you do these types of competitions, and it's two very different choices.
Two often, very different.
Sometimes it's the same.
Sometimes it's the same.
Yeah. But it's fun no matter what.
And then tonight we're rounding out our experience with the Psalms very casually. Mark Orsi's hosting us over at Orsi Winery, but we've just invited, 15 or so winemakers and growers from around the county, bring magnums, special wines, and just having a very casual dinner.
Casual magnum dinner.
Magnum dinner.
Nothing could go wrong.
What could go wrong? So much fun. So much fun.
All right. Well, we better rest. We better get the show on the road
if we're going to
be at an event in 2 seconds. We will be right back on today's Good Stuff. Joining us on today's Good Stuff in studio, we have Scott Rich, founder, winemaker at Talisman Wines. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so we are going to talk about Talisman Wines, of course, but tell us about you. Like, where did you grow up? Where did you come from?
Start at the very, very,
Start at
very,
the very
beginning.
Oh, wow.
and if there's a love story in there somewhere.
I like that.
That's favorite. Yeah. That's Chris's
well,
favorite.
Well, there is. That's actually probably the best part.
I had a feeling. So tell us. Okay, so where'd you grow up?
So I was born in Phoenix, Arizona, and lived there till I was 3. And then we moved to the land of the Mormons.
Oh, wow.
And lived in Salt Lake City while my father was going to college. From the age of 3 till 7, and then moved to Los Angeles. And I grew up in Los Angeles.
Wow. What part?
West LA, sort of Palms, Venice Beach area.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And then went to high school out in the San Fernando Valley, out in Chatsworth. And at the time, it was very rural. It was horse ranches, orange groves, walnut groves. I got to learn how to rock climb while I was there because there was a famous rock climbing spot. I wanted to go to veterinary school originally, and so I worked for horse ranches.
Yeah.
And that was sort of my summer job that put gas in my tank.
So did you work for horse ranches and that inspired wanting to go to veterinary school? Or you, like, how did you decide or what?
Well, no, I knew that I wanted to go to veterinary school. And one of the reasons that I wanted to work at horse ranches is because I thought I'd be a large animal vet.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. That changed once I got into school. I started off as an animal science major, which was great until one of my roommates who had like perfect grades worked for a guy who was the president of the California Veterinary Association. He was a little bit ahead of me in school, and he applied to vet school and was rejected. And
so
I started looking at statistics and thought, you know what? I like academics, but I do not want to be in school until I'm 32 years old straight.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like a 7-year commitment, isn't it?
Yeah,
something
and
like
it's
that.
It's harder to get into than medical school, and I liked it, but I didn't like it that much.
Right.
I don't think I knew that. That's... Yeah, it's, that's
it,
crazy.
At the time, there were only 9 vet schools in the entire United States. Davis had 93 places available every year, and they had something like 1,000 applicants. So it was very, very difficult to get into.
Yeah, extremely. Yeah, interesting.
So I took some time off. I moved up to what is... now known as, oh God, I don't know what it's called now, Squaw Valley at the time.
Oh, yeah, Palisades.
And so became a ski bum for the winter, and then moved to Santa Barbara and took some summer school classes to figure out what I wanted to do instead.
Mm-hmm.
And surfed, waited tables, determined that I was not made out to work in restaurants. really, really hard work. Kudos to anybody who does that.
Service,
It's a tough job. But I discovered land planning, and I ended up with a degree. I went back to UC Davis, finished with a degree in environmental planning and management, and did land planning, landscape architecture, and urban design for about a decade.
Oh.
And then went back to graduate school. And I went back to graduate school at the viticulture and enology department at UC Davis. And if I'd remembered how difficult it was, I probably wouldn't have gone back. but you know, you forget pain. That's part of part of what's good about being human.
Yes, very true.
And before I went back to grad school, I met my wife, which is part of where the romantic thing came in. She had moved from Colorado because somebody had told her that if she wanted to get into the wine industry, she should move to Napa Valley and get a job with Robert Mondavi. And that was exactly what she did. She ended up working for them for 18 years.
Wow. Pre-constellation?
Pre-constellation. Yeah. And her departure was really well timed.
Yeah. Okay.
She was there when the organization was really at its peak. It was sort of the iconic place to be at the time.
Right. And the family was still very involved.
So I want to know this. So I was born in South Dakota, and then when I was 10, we moved to Colorado Springs. So how does someone living in Colorado decide they want to get into wine? Because it's not like that's an obvious choice, at least in my experience.
Well, Marta grew up in Minnesota, except for a quick little, I think, a 3-year stint in Sweden.
Okay.
And her father had always made wine in the basement of their house in Minnesota.
There you go.
And they started off doing like elderberry sparkling wine, fruit wines, and then they started getting a little bit more serious. And when he was sort of at his peak of all of this, he and his buddies would get together and they'd put a little group together and they would buy an entire railroad boxcar of grapes and then have it shipped out to Minnesota. They'd divvy it up among their wine club and they'd all make wine.
So, but wait. So, I mean, Mondavi had a Minnesota connection too.
Yes.
And sending in his family were shipping grapes back to Minnesota. So there was no overlap in any of that.
No, it was purely coincidental. Robert Mondavi was born in Minneapolis. He lived there as a kid. So yeah, there's a definite connection.
Yeah.
But you had asked about a sort of romantic thing.
Yeah.
My wife and I celebrate full moons because we had two dates that I didn't know were dates.
Oh. Otherwise known as screening processes or something?
Well,
what's going on?
Guys are sort of dense. And I thought that it was, you know, a friendly little dinner between a couple of friends. But then I decided, I don't know how I met her. We fell into the same circle of friends, people that I'd met as an undergrad at Davis. And they are still lifelong friends. Many of them are in the wine industry.
Love it. Mm-hmm.
And she just fell into this circle when she moved to St. Helena. And so we went mountain biking together. We went kayaking, canoeing, skiing, all that sort of stuff. And we were both involved with other people when we met, and there was nothing going on. But when I finally figured out that I liked this woman, the first date that we knew was a date was a mountain bike ride to the top of Mount St. Helena.
Ooh, ambitious.
On a full moon during a lunar eclipse.
Oh, wow.
Ooh.
And we got up to the top. We were with one other couple. We got up to the top, and she pulled out a bag of peanut M&Ms. Which was wonderful. And I pulled out a bottle of 1976 Ridge York Creek Cabernet.
Okay, you win. You win.
And the four of us ate the peanut M&Ms and drank the Cabernet. And that was our first date that I knew was a date.
That you can't really top that. I mean, that's a pretty good start.
That was pretty cool.
So she was working at Mondavi at that time. You were in St. Helena. Who were you working for?
Well, I was actually working, when we met, I was working in downtown San Francisco. I was working for a land planning firm.
All right, so you were still
and I didn't want to live in an urban area my entire life. I didn't like the constant deadlines. I didn't like working weekends when clients would call and say, hey, we got a place on the city council agenda for next Tuesday. I know you're not finished with the plans, but you don't mind working on them all weekend, do you?
Yeah.
And I just didn't want to live like that the rest of my life. Harvest is another thing. I know that that's coming. I expect it. And I'm happy to do all of that hard work.
Yeah.
But that's different. I can plan for that.
Yeah.
Okay, so you get inspired at some point, Marta, and big part of that, to pursue wine, it sounds like.
Yeah, I had early on, as soon as I got out of Davis as an undergrad, I was interested in wine. My first exposure to wine, I never saw alcohol in the house when I was a kid. My first exposure to wine was via a guy in my freshman dorm named Stan, who was about 5'3". And Stan was a cowboy, and he introduced me to Mogan David 2020.
Oh, my God.
And it certainly got better from there.
But good for Stan.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
you know, freshman year, like he's pulling up with that.
Yep.
Wow.
And I, once I got out of school, got a job and could afford to buy some wine, I sort of explored it and discovered that it was something that I really liked. I've always liked food, and the two of them go together.
Yeah.
So that was my initial interest in wine.
But to go down the winemaking path, and was that sort of because you seem to have had an aptitude for science if you were thinking about vet school?
That was exactly it. I looked at what my interests were. I had a bunch of friends in the wine industry at the time, so I saw what their lifestyle was like. I saw them enjoying their jobs. They were challenged on a daily basis. They liked what they were doing. I had this incredibly great science background, and it was sort of a natural thing. It was very, very easy for me to slide into the grad school thing because I knew how to do research. I just didn't know how to make wine. And my first job in the wine industry was bestowed upon me by a guy named Clark Smith, who is still around. I suspect you know him.
Yeah.
And Clark was at the R.H. Phillips Vineyard at the time, and he needed someone to do research for him because they were out where nobody had ever grown grapes before. Mm-hmm.
And it's like Dunnigan Hills, right?
Yeah, Hills. And so he hired me to do research because I knew how to do experiments. And so we set up a winemaking protocol because that's part of keeping things uniform for the experiments. But one of the funny things about that job was that one of my responsibilities was also to sample vineyards. And they had 200 or 300 acres of vineyards. It was a lot.
Yeah.
They gave me the most dangerous toy in the world, one of those little Honda three-wheel ATVs.
Off you went.
Yeah. It was great. And their rule of thumb was that I needed to stop sampling either at 11 o'clock in the morning or as soon as the temperature got to 80. Sometimes it would be 80 at like 7:30 or 8.
Yeah, it gets hot out there.
It gets really hot out there. Huh. But it was a great platform to start my winemaking career. My first year, I made 120 some odd lots of wine. It takes me a long time to make that much now.
Yeah, that's a lot. That's
and then the following year, I was able to do a similar job with Robert Mondavi down at their Woodbridge facility. Mm-hmm. And it was better funded, better organized. And I did, I think, 230 lots that year. So my first 2 years in the wine industry, I did about 250 different lots of wine.
It's a good education.
And it was a great education. I did that on purpose because I saw some of my compatriots in grad school taking internships where they would go to a famous winery and then push the button on the press, watch it cycle, then dump it, clean it up, and then load it up and cycle it again. And so you do the same thing. And I didn't see that as a really great way to learn about winemaking. Yeah. I wanted to be fully immersed and see the entire cycle. And part of the gig at R.H. Phillips was training not only making the wines, but then bottling the wines, training tasting panels, doing tastings to see what the results were, and then doing statistical analysis to determine whether or not any of this stuff was valid. So my first two jobs were incredibly great.
Yeah, what a great learning.
I'm trying to remember, and you might have been the reason for this, but wasn't R.H. Phillips one of the pioneers in night picking?
They were. They were the first vineyard in the world to pick at night, and it was
really?
Because
I don't think I knew that.
Yeah, it would get to be 105, 110 out there
really
on a regular basis.
Yeah,
and so they did it out of necessity. It was a really smart move, and they were also brilliant marketers, and that was a lot of what made their winery successful. They were very willing to try things that nobody else had tried before.
I love that.
And they were smart about it, and it was a great first job.
Yeah, what a way to learn. Incredible. Okay, so then the Woodbridge facility as well. I mean, that was probably at its height. I mean, Woodbridge
was the machine that was making everything else at Mondavi work at the time.
Yeah.
And it was again, an incredible job. I saw vineyards all over that part of the Central Valley.
Yeah.
Saw different techniques in vineyards. We did experiments trying to modify microclimates and canopies with misters, fans, screens, all sorts of things. We were one of the first people to do experiments with the sorts of filtration that we use now, cross-flow filtration. So it was a great place to work as well.
We'll take a quick break. We will come right back on with Scott Rich. Good stuff with our guest, Scott Rich, founder, winemaker at Talisman Wines. So we haven't even gotten to Talisman yet.
I know, we're just 2 years out of school.
I know, we're a couple years out of school, we're working at Woodbridge, we're working at R.H. Phillips.
And you're dating. water at this time? For perspective.
Well, actually, by the time I got out of grad school, we were married.
Okay, there you go. All right.
Yeah.
Just want to figure out where that falls into the story timeline. Virginie knows I love the love story part.
I know. I know you needed it to be that specific.
Well, I need to know how you fell in love with wine and then how you, you know, yeah. fell in love. Period. Yes, there you go. Mm.
Anyway. Okay. So from Woodbridge, you're this happily married couple. What do you start talking about starting your own thing? Like, where does that come from?
Yeah. No, not at all. I went to work for a place as winemaker. Now it's Madonna Estate. At the time it was Mont Saint John. And I went for two reasons. One, Larry Brooks, who was a winemaker at Acacia at the time, he's now down on the Central Coast, told me that the very best Pinot Noir he had ever made was the 1982 Madonna Vineyard Pinot Noir at Acacia. And so Mont Saint John owned that vineyard. And the other thing that I had going for me is that they just hired Mary Edwards as a consultant. And so I thought, this is cool. I'll have this great vineyard and I will have an instant mentor. And so I'm set up just by sheer luck with the second great mentor in my career. And was there for a few years. But after the first year, I got there in 1992, did the 92 vintage, and then the owner decided that he wasn't paying me enough, but he couldn't pay me enough. So he gave me 3 tons of Pinot Noir. And I, of course, had to do something with that.
Yeah.
And we made wine, and that's how...
As one does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's how Talisman started. We were sort of forced into it, but it turned out to be a good thing for us. And so I hunted down a 1-ton basket press because I didn't want to use... They had all of this old Valley Foundry equipment, and I wanted to try and be sort of cutting edge and be as gentle as possible.
They were gentle, yeah.
So a friend of mine who was working with a really good destemmer put it in the back of his truck and brought it to me. And we got going with that. And then once it was time to press, we had this beautiful basket press to press with. And we bought a handful of barrels, and that was our first vintage.
That was it. Okay.
Wow. Yeah.
And so was Pinot already something that you knew you wanted to focus on, or this was just really serendipitous?
Yeah. I had immersed myself enough in wine that I had learned what I liked, what I didn't like. And Pinot was the thing that fascinated me the most because it was more expressive relative to sight than anything else that I had tasted. And the spectrum of Pinot Noir styles, flavors, aromas, everything else, much broader than any of the other varieties that I had explored. And so I was sort of pulled in by that.
Okay, so you get this first amount of Pinot. Do you start labeling it Talisman? What were the discussions?
Well, we had a couple of years to think about that.
a couple.
But yeah, that's what eventually happened. I purchased grapes from my boss the following year, and then started trying to diversify just a little bit. And so I started exploring other vineyards in Carneros at the time. And we stayed small till 1999. We were 200 cases, 93, 94, 95, 96, 97, 98. And then in 99, we finally had sold enough wine and accumulated enough money to double our production to 400 cases a year.
And big time.
Yeah.
The big time.
Yeah, it was a big, scary step. But we did that, and we expanded into Russian River at that point, and also into the Sebastopol area. And I discovered that that was sort of my sweet spot for what I was interested in. And for me, the whole thing is if somebody can identify a wine that I make as a Scott Rich wine, I've completely failed at my mission. What I'm trying to do is make wines that express the place where those grapes were born.
The vineyards.
Yeah. And that to me is what it's all about. It's this expression of terroir.
Yeah.
And so that's what drove us. And we eventually were able to slowly parlay this into other vineyards. One of the things that we wanted to do was have no investors, no debt, no partners, because I've seen too many wine ventures implode as a result of different expectations, different needs. And so our growth was really, really slow, and it was very, very organic. We both had other jobs and were working for other people for a very, very long time. And that's how we were able to grow the brand over time.
But you really have ridden like an incredible time in Pinot Noir in California. I mean, those years, like the buildup was...
He was ahead of it, actually.
I know, you were ahead of it. And so finding vineyards was probably an interesting challenge to some extent. Like, what changed over those years?
Well, I think the big thing for me is that when I was at Davis, I took as many vineyard classes as I possibly could, which was pretty much all of them. And when I took jobs, I was interested in jobs where vineyards were an important part of it. I ran Carneros Creek, for instance, for a year and made the wines there. Many people will know that the owner of Carneros Creek, Francis Mahoney, was one of the early proponents of different clones. And he did a lot of clonal research early on that nobody else was doing. And so those were the sorts of things that drove me and interested me.
Yeah, so you knew what to look for.
Yeah, and the other thing that happened is I'm still not sure how this happened, but, you know, growers talk to each other. And I somehow got a reputation of being a fun and reasonable winemaker to work with. And I know that not all winemakers have that. A lot of them
not
are sort of a
growers,
pain in the rear.
Imagine.
Yeah, I was going to say the growers maybe not all feel that way. But
yeah. And so I started having growers call me saying that, you know, Joe over here, who you've been buying grapes from, told us to call you. And so that's sort of how that happened. And to me, that was like the highest compliment.
Yeah, that is a great compliment. And Talisman, where'd the name come from?
My mother, who died a couple of years ago, was Native American. And one of the things that she gave me was a little object that had been made and blessed by a medicine man. And I won't tell you what it was called in the native tongue, but it was sort of the equivalent of a St. Christopher medal for a Catholic.
Okay.
It was supposed to protect the bearer. And it used to hang from the rearview mirror of my truck. And I was driving down the road to a vineyard one day, looking at this, thinking, you know, it'd be really cool. And this was early on, obviously. It would be really cool if I could incorporate this object as part of my story, because it's
so
I
meaningful.
Grew up with this this sort of cultural mindset. And I thank my mother for giving me a lot of really positive values.
I love that.
And I looked at it and thought, well, I can't really talk about this thing and say its name because nobody would understand it. And then it occurred to me that it was a good luck charm. It was a talisman. And there's a difference between a talisman and an amulet. An amulet has powers that are just part of that object. A talisman, on the other hand, is an object who's had powers imbued by an outside force. In this case, it was the medicine man.
Incredible.
And so that's how the whole talisman thing came up.
Okay, quick break, and we'll come right back on with Scott Rich. With our guest guest, Scott Rich, founder, winemaker at Talisman Wines. And what an amazing story about the name.
The name.
I mean, talisman is a word that many of us have heard many times, but I had no idea. Like, and then the personal significance, of course.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Thank you.
And thank you.
And go, Mom.
And go, Mom. Always.
I love that.
Here's to moms everywhere.
Yeah, right?
The positive values.
Yes. I love that.
Well, now might be a good time to talk about. I mean, you know, you're a Pinot Noir specialist since very early on. So tell us, how many wines are you making these days? They're all single vineyards, I imagine. Tell us a little bit about the lineup.
Well, we work with I think the last count was 13 different vineyards. Okay. And of those, most of the wines that we make are just single vineyard wines. But we will occasionally make something special from one of those vineyards as well. And one of the things that we've started doing, well, we've done this for a long time, but the past few vintages, I've really piled onto this, is 100% whole cluster fermentation. Mm-hmm. So something called Method Ancien, which is what the Burgundians did before they had machines to destem with. And we find that these wines that we make using this technique produce wines with greater structure, greater longevity, which was one of our goals when we started out, and just more interesting wines. They've got more layers, they've got more texture, they've got more everything.
Mm-hmm.
But they're a little nerve wracking sometimes.
you have to know the site. You have to know everything about it. Yeah,
you've got to trust that you've got to trust that everything has been done properly with the grapes. And my role is, as a winemaker, is to simply not screw up what my growers have done.
Mm-hmm. That's
cool. So we made Pinot Noir for the longest time. Once we got a tasting room, which is the oldest commercial building in downtown Glen Ellyn, I started getting pressure to make rosé, and I finally succumbed to that. And then there was pressure to make a white wine, and I didn't really want to make a white wine because, you know, everybody thinks of Chardonnay, and I hate to say this, but there's enough Chardonnay in the world.
Okay.
We don't agree.
We love the Chardonnay, but we grow 26% of our vineyard.
Yeah, and you don't have to do it.
Chardonnay in Sonoma County.
Well, I ended up working with Dutton Ranch with Pinot Blanc.
Yeah. We've heard of it.
And we just recently received 99 points from the North Coast Wine Challenge for our 2024 Pinot
awesome.
Blanc.
Those grape prices are going to go up.
Yeah.
Be careful there. Yeah.
And so we've been making Pinot Blanc since, I think, 2019. And then just a few years ago, again, because of a little pressure from the tasting room, we started making some Chardonnay. And the Chardonnay comes from...
Oh, you totally fell into the trap. Come on.
I did, but I went back to a block of grapes that I had worked with when I was at Carneros Creek.
Okay.
And so the Chardonnay is sourced from the Green Acre. Acres block of San Giacomo.
Oh, nice. Yep. Okay.
The fruit's fabulous, and people seem to like the wine, so that seems to be a good thing.
And so it's very grower specific. Then you have these long-standing relationships, and it's site and grower.
Long-standing relationships are really, really important to me. Our oldest relationship goes back to 1996.
Yeah. Wow.
And most of our current growers we've worked at least for a decade with.
Yeah.
So what can people expect? They can come to the tasting room in Glen Ellyn. Is it by appointment? Do people just waltz in?
It's easiest by appointment, but you can usually waltz in and taste. Our staff in the tasting room is there. They sort of like to judge what people are interested in, and they will throw anything that you show an interest in at you. And what you're going to discover is that we make a whole bunch of different wines that have really, really distinctive personalities. And it you won't mistake one wine for another. They're not sort of monolithic in their style or or their flavors. They're all really, really different, just like people. And one of the things I like to do is use analogies with people to describe wines because they all have personalities that are distinct.
I like that.
So if I am a sassy, fun, bold, what would I be drinking? I think I want to, this would be a fun little game.
Exactly.
So, yes. Bossy, oh wait, yeah. Jeff, our producer, would like to know which wine represents bossy.
No
okay,
bossy
thanks,
wines.
Jeff. Yeah. Thanks, Jeff. I'll remember that, Jeff.
Well, it is. It's in a great part of Glenallen. I can attest to that. You're right near Glenallen Star. You're near lots of places to eat. It's a great spot. That's so people should go down to Talisman.
It's like the best two blocks.
Yeah.
Incredible.
It's an awesome little building. As I said, it's the oldest commercial building. It started off as a hotel. We've got a local historian that did a history of the building for us, which is on one of the walls in the tasting room. One of the fun things about it is that we've got a little oriental rug in the front. And if you pull up the edge of that rug, you will see a now sealed up hatch in the floor that used to lead to a speakeasy underneath.
Oh, bring it back.
Let's do that.
Well, I've been down there, and you don't want to go down there. It's not very comfortable.
All right. Well, everybody, it's been nice to have you, Scott, and go visit Talisman in downtown Glenallen. Thank you so much for joining us on The Good Stuff.
Thank you very much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Wrapping things up on The Good Stuff, and we need to talk about Tuesday Night Wines.
I know.
And speakeasies underneath rugs.
I know.
I don't know if that's my preferred style of speakeasy.
I like
one that you can just walk into.
Yeah.
I don't want stairs down.
I don't need stairs down. It reminds me when I snuck into a college bar. If you're underage, you had to go down the stairs. The fact it was Philly. I don't know.
I'm surprised they didn't just go through the window or something.
No, we did go through the... Well, you went down and then through the window and you would be in the basement.
That's if you talk smack about the Eagles.
Sounds fun.
You get sent through the window.
Yeah.
Wait a minute.
Definitely.
Show up
in a Steelers jersey, for example. Yeah, you're in trouble. They'll throw you through.
All right. What are you doing? What are you doing Tuesday?
Well, they do make a fair amount of Pinot Noirs that are all lovely. So I'm going to go Starscape. Starscape Pinot Noir, Russian River Valley. I don't know, something about the full moon.
I know, inspiration.
Bike rides, hikes, whatever.
Peanut M&Ms.
Falling out of planes. It made me think Starscape.
And they seem like they're very active, from surfing to skydiving.
M&Ms. Just bring peanut M&Ms, do anything.
I do want some peanut M&Ms.
I know.
Well, of course, there's such an obvious selection, and I know it's in my cellar, but the Talisman Pinot Blanc from Dutton Ranch.
I love that Pinot Blanc in general, so it'd be really fun to try theirs.
I actually really love Pinot Blanc, period.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. Well, there you go. So their Glenallen tasting room is open daily 11 to 5. Appointments encouraged. Walk-ins welcome. They are at 13651 Arnold Drive, Glenallen. And you can email tastingroom@talismanwine.com if for some reason you want to, book ahead.
I think you should book ahead.
And then don't forget, fall through the hatch.
I was going to say, make sure you pull up the rug and see the little patch in the floor where historically there was a speakeasy.
If that's okay. To do that.
That's what he said.
And then go to Glenallen Star while you're there.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Where else? There's a martini bar across.
Oh.
So start with the Talisman, go to the martini bar, then Glenallen Star, and then...
I didn't know about the martini bar.
Mm-hmm.
Fun.
Okay.
Okay,
lots
the good
to
stuff.
Do in Glenallen.
I would say Glenallen's, bumping.
Bumping.
Is that a word?
Bumping.
That makes me sound very old. Okay. I'm looking at a producer. Bumpin'. He basically is like,
it's totally tubular. Don't worry about it.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, there. You've heard it from the expert.
Gosh. And
and what a great story. And love the kind of founder story and the name. And again, shout out to Mom, the tie back to his mom and Talisman. So.
And focusing on single vineyard Pinot Noir since mid-90s, good for him.
I kind of want to sit down and have him describe each wine as a person, because I think that would be a hoot with him.
I think you can.
That's Okay, I'm going to have to do that.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us on today's Good Stuff from Sonoma County to wherever you are. Remember to drink the good stuff.
Cheers to that.